You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 7th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by The Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and later in the show from the Monocle Cafe just down the road. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill. On today's show...
Many people are disappointed, really, from the taxi drivers to the people working in the conference to the business leaders and politicians I've spoken to. People really think that what was meant to get done here won't get done because Obama isn't here.
Apex on and Obama's out. Raffaello Pantucci and Alessio Patalano discuss the big Asia summit that's taking place in Bali without the US president. I hear he had a few pressing matters to attend to back home. Also on the show, an American military operation swaps drones for commandos. We consider the global consequences.
It's really the expansion of the American theater of operations as more and more local and regional groups subscribe to Al-Qaeda's ideology and attack neighboring countries.
And we're at the Genoa Yacht Show.
The Italians are the benchmark. Everybody is setting their boats up against. And so we want to be part of this family. We want to be recognized as one of the leading powerboat manufacturers.
We'll also be meeting writer Adam Thirlwell for coffee and conversation over at the Monocle Cafe. All that plus some great music, and we'll look ahead to the rest of the day on Monocle 24 too. That's Aperitivo with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, right now. So lots to come in the next hour here on Aperitivo, but before all that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. At least 22 people have been killed in a series of explosions across the Iraqi capital of Baghdad. There are reports of at least six apparently coordinated bomb attacks in mainly commercial areas of the city. The majority were reported in mainly Shia districts, but a predominantly Sunni Muslim neighbourhood was also hit, according to Reuters news agency. Iraq has seen a sharp rise in sectarian violence in recent months. Nearly 6,000 people have so far been killed this year. Attacks in different regions of Egypt have killed at least 9 soldiers and police officers. Officials said a car bomb killed 3 police officers in southern Sinai hours after masked gunmen shot dead 6 soldiers in a patrol car outside the Suez city of Ismailia. President Hamid Karzai has criticized NATO for failing to bring stability to Afghanistan in more than a decade there. He said NATO had incorrectly focused the fight on Afghan villages rather than Taliban safe havens in Pakistan. The Americans James Rothman and Randy Scheckman and Germany's Thomas Suthoff have won the 2013 Nobel Medicine Prize for their work on how hormones are transported within and outside cells. The research gives insight into diseases such as diabetes and Alzheimer's and sheds light on how insulin is manufactured and released. Elaine Zierath chairs the Nobel Committee.
The 2013 Nobel Prize honors three scientists who have solved the mystery of how the cell organizes its transport system. The three Nobel laureates have discovered the molecular principles that govern how this molecular cargo is delivered with precision to the right place at the right time in the cell. Their discoveries have had a major impact to advance the understanding of the machinery regulating vesicle traffic, a major transport system in the cell.
The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has defended the capture of an alleged Al-Qaeda leader, Anas al-Libi, as a legal and appropriate target. Libi is a suspected mastermind of the 1998 U.S. Embassy attacks in Africa. His son, Abdullah al-Rahi, said his father had been seized by masked gunmen and that some of them were Libyans. Azerbaijan holds a presidential election on Wednesday that looks certain to give President Ilham Aliyev another 5 years in power. Opponents of Mr. Aliyev say controls on dissent mean they have little chance of stopping him winning a third five-year term. His victory would extend a dynastic rule under which he and his father, former communist leader Heydar Aliyev, have ruled the mainly Muslim state since 1969. Opinion polls show Mr. Aliyev clearly in the lead, and his representative Asef Hajayev says the reason is obvious.
Ilham Aliyev will win. And the difference between him and other candidates will be very large. because, you know, but the people support Ilham Aliyev, because look to the development of Azerbaijan last 10 years. Azerbaijan is a wonderful country, wonderful city. Look to the street, look to the building, look to the salary of the people.
And the South African anti-apartheid campaigner Desmond Tutu has been given an orphaned penguin for his 82nd birthday. The former Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town was helping to clean up the Marconi Beam Township near Cape Town when he was presented with a penguin by representatives of a leading marine conservation non-profit organisation. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. Well, it's an original present. You've got to give them that, an orphan penguin.
Well, I was pleased when I read it because I actually had a penguin biscuit today for the first time in about 25 years.
And I thought, synchronicity.
Oh, how about that?
That's complete coincidence, was it?
Total.
Not only orphan.
I didn't know you could get them. But anyway, happy birthday to the Archbishop. Never mind my biscuit eating.
Exactly. Happy birthday. What a legend he is. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. It's 6 minutes past the hour here in London, and we'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
And this is Aperitivo. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill. The time here is 17 minutes past 6 o'clock in the evening. It's 13:07 in New York. Now, we've got some hefty stories to tackle on the show today. And for their take on the news, I'm delighted to be joined in the studio now by Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the London-based defence think tank, the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, and Alessio Patalano, Lecturer in East Asian Warfare and Security at King's College London. A very warm welcome to you both. For once, it is actually warm in London. I can say that without irony.
It's shocking, isn't it?
Really is shocking. Now, today marks the beginning of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Bali, Indonesia. And perhaps the biggest talking point so far has been the absence of President Barack Obama. That's left China's leader, some are saying Xi Jinping, as the dominant leader at the opening session, and potentially gives China a bit of a strategic hand just when the US can least afford to concede any such thing. We're going to hear momentarily from our Bureau Chief in Hong Kong. But just before we kick off, just a quick take from you two. Do you think that's the case? Do you think Obama has squandered an extraordinary opportunity? Alessio?
Well, I think what is happening is that we're looking at the situation where this is not the only signal we're getting. So it's coming on the back of growing doubts about the whole pivot or rebalancing to Asia. So in that respect, perhaps there is a missed chance. But otherwise, you know, diplomatic ties in the region are quite solid.
Raffaello?
I mean, I thought it was fascinating. I was reading John Kerry's speech just before he came here, and it's funny because he spends a good chunk of it about, you know, the first third is basically justifying America's role and sort of explaining that this has nothing to do with Asia, it's an internal problem. And, you know, the fact that he's got to go through all those niceties is, I think, demonstrative of a concern that, you know, I think Alessio's right. It's a bit easy to overstate it, but I think it's definitely live.
Well, and no less a figure than Vladimir Putin, of course, stepped into Obama's defence and said he was justified in missing it. And you've got to be worrying whenever
yes,
Putin
validates
what you've just done. Well, we're going to be hearing, as I said, from our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. She's there. She's got the local reaction to Obama's no-show.
Well, Prime Minister Lee from Singapore did yesterday kind of make a little bit of a joke about it during his session. And then there was a question posed to President Aquino. Of course, we know the Philippines are big allies of the United States. Someone from the audience posed a question to him, you know, kind of trying to explain why Obama was not there, which I think was a rather strange thing to ask the leader of a completely separate country. He said the Filipinos understood and that his government was okay with it. But many people are disappointed, really, from the taxi drivers, to the people working in the conference, to the business leaders and politicians I've spoken to. People really think that nothing is, that what was meant to get done here, especially with to do with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, won't get done because Obama isn't here. While John Kerry can speak to it, people here, especially in Indonesia, who they have such a strong tie to Obama, they were really looking forward to him being here.
Well, let's talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Is it dead in the water, even Indonesia's sparkly blue waters, because Obama isn't there? Would it have made any difference were he to be there? I mean, we're talking the biggest free trade agreement in the world, 12 countries, huge amount of money at stake. But what's the likelihood of this actually happening, particularly on the time frame that they're talking about?
Well, I mean, my understanding is that the leaders that have sort of referred to it still seem to think that it's on track. I mean, Tony Abbott, I noticed, said some comments about, you know, not to worry, this is still sort of going to go ahead towards the end of the year. And I think certainly the American delegation is talking about it in that sort of way. So I think there's a definite desire for it to still happen and for it to still happen on the timeline that's been determined. I mean, in many ways, I would compare it to the transatlantic equivalent of this that was also being discussed, which is being kicked into touch as well because of the delays and the sort of US delegation go there. The US delegation isn't actually going over to meet them. So I think there we could see that one is definitely getting pushed further into the future. But I think the Trans-Pacific one is one that there's a lot of interest and there's been a lot of work that's gone into it from the US side. And I think they definitely still want to make it happen to the timelines that they've said.
Alessia, you were talking about the fact that you think that this actually indicates perhaps that this great pivot that we've heard talked about so often in American foreign policy is perhaps not as, it's not as likely to happen as we've been led to believe. And what role does the TPP play in that, whether or not it comes into fruition or not?
Well, the first thing to say is that it's not that it's not likely to happen. It's certainly going to happen because we have a schedule. We have a sort of a time frame. We're looking down to 2015 and 17 as the main signposts for this to be put in place. So it's not that it's not going to happen, but perhaps we've seen less than what we were expecting, you know, even in terms of when the Obama administration launched it, it was attached to a first sort of important sign of this is going to be the deployment of 2,500 Marines in Australia. Well, so far, we haven't seen that happening. The number in itself was relatively small and the assets that were to be deployed in Australia and then in Singapore were relatively limited. And they still remain quite lower to the expectation that was given to it at the beginning. So in this respect, as I say, the problem is that what is happening with the shutdown of the American administration of the past couple of weeks is happening in a context where there's a number of mixed signs. And if I may say that, you know, when you see Xi Jinping with his wife walking out of a plane in Indonesia and then going and talk to the Indonesians, well, you know, it does give a visual image somehow of someone who's kind of like a stepping in a relatively sort of vacuum, politically speaking.
Mm. Well, Raffaello, of course, China not one of the economies involved in the TPP. How significant is it that Xi Jinping was making that speech to the ASEAN nations, talking about a volume of trade with those countries that would reach $1 trillion by 2020.
Well, I mean, in some ways it's not surprising. China's right there. China does a lot of trade with these countries already. The fact that those volumes are going to grow, I mean, China's a huge economy of 1.3 billion people that are increasingly consuming. And so, you know, it's natural that these sorts of figures would be sort of happening. I think in some ways what Alessio was hinting at there, and I would even say, look back at his trip in Central Asia that we saw around the G20 summit in St. Petersburg. You know, the deals that he signed in Central Asia were, you know, pretty huge. We're talking $30 billion in Kazakhstan, $3 billion in Kyrgyzstan. These are big sums of money. And now we're seeing the same thing happening out here in this part of Asia. I think in some ways what we're seeing here is that the Xi administration is sort of expressing its foreign policy, and it's very much expressing its foreign policy in a way that kind of echoes the American, the Obama approach, you know, the American approach in general, which is, you know, we are the big power. Here we are to come and talk about this and sign huge deals and do all this great big stuff. And what's missing here is that the American president isn't doing that. You know, he's sending a secretary of state instead. And that does, it has a sort of an impact, a sort of emotional, a reactive impact on the world stage.
What would the world have done if Obama had not, what would have happened if Obama had gone to Indonesia? Would people have been complaining about the fact he wasn't there trying to rescue not only the US economy, but let's face it, essentially the global economy?
No, what I think we would have seen more stories about Obama in Asia as well. You know, we would have seen more about him visiting his childhood home in Jakarta or something. You know, here all we're seeing is stories of Xi Jinping giving a speech to the Indonesian parliament. Mm. Xi Jinping gives a big speech in Malaysia. Xi Jinping has a discussion with the New Zealand prime minister. It's all about Xi and China going out and all these sorts of things. And it's just not getting any, the US side of it is all about US retreat from Asia. And, these have a sort of psychological impact. As your reporter said, it's down to the taxi drivers at this point, all these sorts of things. Now, yes, this isn't a sort of overnight shift one way or the other, but, it does show a signal that, we've got a China that's growing and is increasingly showing itself on the world stage. And we see an America that is clearly has all these difficulties at home that has to address.
Alessia, let's pull focus for a moment to the global recovery in Asia generally. I mean, the Asian economies have shown relative resilience, relative being the operative word, because obviously global recovery has been incredibly patchy and volatile. And there was a fairly gloomy economic forecast made in a statement by the foreign and trade ministers for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group. What kind of context are we looking at in terms of the economic picture overall, and not just the big economies that we've been focusing on?
Well, I mean, that is actually a very interesting question that ties in with what we were talking about just moments ago. When Xi Jinping comes around and he gives his big talk to the Indonesian people, he was talking about certain problems that experience the relationship between China and Southeast Asia in a wider sense, hinting, of course, to the problems of the maritime dispute. But that is not just about that. The problem is that whilst China's trade with Southeast Asia is growing, and China is an important sort of economic engine to regional growth and that kind of resilience that you mentioned moments ago, on the other hand, China represents a fundamental competitor for most of these Southeast Asian countries. Companies in Southeast Asia are producing, those that are more remunerative in the economic context are almost in direct competition with their Chinese counterparts. So in this respect, Trans-Pacific partnership brings about crucial questions that are sort of flagging up an issue that is unlikely to go away in the nearby future. And that is, at the political level, we want to stay aligned with the United States because we know what we're getting out of that deal. On the other hand, China is the closest neighbor. It's economically very important, and we don't really know how to deal with it. So that's the sort of dilemma that is coming back, that is coming up, that is unlikely to go away in the near future.
Let's talk about one of the other big economies. We're going to hear once again from our correspondent, Aisha Spears, who's on the ground over there to talk about the focus on Japan.
Prime Minister Lee from Singapore said something very interesting in his session yesterday, which was that China can't be the only story in Asia and that we have to also look at Japan and Abenomics. And I think, you look at this session, it's held in Southeast Asia. We're all talking about the incredible growth that these Southeast Asian nations are seeing currently, from Indonesia to Thailand to the Philippines. And obviously we're talking about the influence of China both economically and geopolitically. And I think that often it's easy to forget that Japan is still a key player. For Indonesia, it's the biggest trading partner.
And what's mostly on Japan's agenda? What do they need out of this? Raffaello?
Japan is, has clearly been, Abe has now come in. He's trying to sort of strengthen himself and his role in the region. Japan has always been something of the overlooked sort of superpower in the region. You always talk about, as you said, it's always about China and China, what China's going out. But what's interesting about Japan is that we are seeing under sort of Abe a potential reopening of the country and its sort of affirmation of maybe its role. Within the TPP, I have to be honest and say that Alessio knows far more about this than I do.
Well, Alessio, it is your subject, so let's move over to you.
Well, I think competitiveness is what the Japanese economy needs. Japanese industries, they welcome Abe's comeback because he had a clear agenda. He wanted to put Japanese industry again back on track in terms of competitiveness, particularly in those areas where they've been losing over the past few years to South Korean competitors and partly in less measure to Chinese competitors. So in this respect, I think that what also Abe is trying to do is to build up momentum of the dilemma that I mentioned a moment ago existing across the region in a wider sense, as to China is a big political player. We don't really know, however, in the medium long term, what kind of impact that will bring about to our domestic and political economies across the region. So here the Japanese are coming in saying, like, look, you know, we've been around for much longer than the Chinese have, and we're not asking for anything in particular because we produce in different, we are occupying different parts of the market. So let's talk about how we can work together rather than try to cut corners and sort of balance things off. And I think that is a very clever thing that obviously speaks straight to the very heart of the political and economic reforms that Abe is trying to push through with Abenomics.
Just very quickly before we move on temporarily, I was intrigued by a quote from Eugene Tan, who's an associate law professor at Singapore Management University. He said, "We're seeing a lot more economic diplomacy at work because of the competition among the powers that are seeking a slice of the action here. So far, so obvious." He says, "Everyone's putting their best foot forward and playing nice rather than trying to impose their economic desires or plans on these countries which have no shortage of suitors." What kind of leverage do the smaller economies have?
Well, I mean, they are growing economies, you know, and growing potential economies. So there's that sense of all these big countries want to sort of invest in there because it's a potential market that they can sort of try to cultivate as their particular one. I think there's an interesting question here, which I find fascinating, which is, you know, this whole idea of what is described as checkbook diplomacy, which is something that was very much a Japanese-driven thing. You know, they sort of go around the world and write big checks to do development projects and whatever, you know, and it was just, this was their way of winning friends and, you know, buying friends, really. What's interesting is the Chinese kind of do it in a say, they also have this tendency to do it, but the way they do it seems to be different. But at the same time, it's the same. They write these big checks through their development banks, but they're much more attached to building big pieces of infrastructure than there's a perception that they will therefore own this part of the country. So in some ways, I find it fascinating, the sort of dichotomy between the two, because in some ways, it's actually very similar, the approach that they're doing. But the impact and the way it's sort of read is wildly different.
We're going to have to leave it there temporarily, as I say, and take a short break. Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI and Alessio Patilano from King's College London are, though, I'm happy to say, going nowhere while we take this very quick short break here on Aperitivo. When we return, we'll be looking at the global implications of the recent US commando operation in Libya. Stay with us.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet. The single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
The Nobel Peace Prize for 2009 is to be awarded to President Barack Obama.
As the Nobel committees in Stockholm and Oslo prepare to announce this year's laureates, Monocle 24 takes an in-depth look at the prizes founded by Alfred Nobel in 1895. We'll speak to previous winners.
It can't be underestimated. Thanks to this Nobel Peace Prize, probably many people around the world for the first time heard about the landmine problem.
Go behind the scenes of the ceremonies themselves. And speak to those who believe today's awards have strayed far from Alfred Nobel's original vision.
They spat in the face of Nobel on the same week as they had received the prize.
That's the Nobel Prizes, a series of special reports, all this week on The Globalist and The Globalist Asia, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill and the time is 23 minutes past the hour. Still with me here in the studio are Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the London-based defence think tank RUSI, and Alessio Patilano, Lecturer in East Asian Warfare and Security at King's College London. Lovely to have you both, gentlemen. Thanks for staying with us. And it's time now to move the conversation to the recent US military raids, one of which captured the accused Al-Qaeda operative Abu Anas al-Libi, the other in Somalia failed to capture its target. Now, one of the most interesting aspects of the operations was the absence of that favourite tool in the military's recent kit, the unmanned aerial drone. Both raids were carried out by beating hearts and boots on the ground. Well, a little earlier, we spoke with Fawaz Jerjes, Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics and author of the books Obama and the Middle East and The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda. Let's take a listen.
The US has used a combination of tools and tactics over the last 11 years or so. Mostly, the Obama administration has relied on drone attacks in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, and other places. But also the administration has sent commandos to basically eliminate or neutralize Osama bin Laden. Many commando operations, I mean, I'm talking about dozens of commando operations have taken place in Afghanistan and Pakistan, in the African theater. What's really new about what has happened in the last 48 hours is America's deepening involvement in what we call in regional theaters, particularly North Africa, where groups, militant groups, who subscribe to Al-Qaeda's ideology, in particular the attack in Somalia and also the attack which basically captured Alibi in Libya. This represents a deepening involvement, not just in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen. It's really the expansion of the American theater of operations as more and more local and regional groups subscribe to Al-Qaeda's ideology and attack neighboring countries, as Al-Shabaab's attacks a while back, about 2 weeks ago, at the Wastegate shopping center showed very clearly.
Fawaz Jerjes, Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics, talking to Monocle a little earlier. I mean, it's clear that this does mark a shift. Obama has obviously sought to sort of distance himself from the big and very costly theatres of conflict like Iraq and Afghanistan. And clearly they've been investing very heavily in these high value targets and this new sort of operations, as it were. What are your thoughts? How significant really is this, Alessio?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that there is an element of continuity, though. You know, let me blow my own horn for a second.
Absolutely.
Because, allow me to do that. You know, sea power does matter, and the possibility to operate from the sea or by means of small teams inserting themselves into particular areas to hit particular targets. This is something that has been going on forever. You know, that there's no novelty in there. And it proves very much the alternative to the strategy that had been put in place, which was, well, we get into a place, we take control, and we try to make it better. This is the opposite. It's like we stay offshore, and we intervene against high-value targets to find not an overall solution, but to reduce the strategic impact of whatever it is the target that we're looking at, in this case, this terrorist group. So it seems to me, in that respect, it is certainly moving away, but it's not sort of discovering something new. It's going back to something that already existed, and it was very much part of the tools of statecraft in the past.
Raffaello, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's something that the US has been doing. I mean, Fawaz Jerjes mentioned this as well. I mean, you know, this is not the first time they've done a strike in Somalia. Back in 2009, 2010, they hit a very senior Al-Qaeda guy who was out there, Saleh Naban. And, you know, they've had other operations. Osama bin Laden's the most prominent one. But we've had other ones that, you know, haven't necessarily gone to headlines either. Mm. That have sort of snuck under there. So I think in some ways, what this particular incident really demonstrates, I think it's more about two things. It's about the disaggregation of Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaedist ideas. It's scattered around the world. We're increasingly seeing these regional groups that are popping up in these sort of dangerous hotspots. And there's individuals there who are attempting to plot against the West. And so I think this is partially a recognition of that. Striking two in one day is a U.S. demonstration that, you know, we can do this. We can handle this sort of an effort. And, you know, this doesn't mean that you're going to manage to get away with it. I think the interesting thing also to note is about Al-Libi is that this is a man who, it's unclear how operational he still was. He had been an operative who was involved in the sort of 90s with Al-Qaeda. He was a very senior guy because of his longevity and the amount of time he'd been involved with the group, not necessarily in operational terms. There's been some implication that maybe he was involved in the sort of growing training camps that we've seen appearing in the southern Libya that have produced, you know, terrorist groups, including some of the guys who hit the In Amenas site in Algeria earlier in the year. But in some ways, it's a sort of American demonstration that, you know, this is a guy who they wanted for a crime that was committed almost 15 years ago, and they still managed to track him down. You know, and this just sort of shows, you know, we have a long memory for these things.
Yep.
And it sort of shows a bigger strategic point to these terrorist groups, that there is nowhere you can hide and that we will remember you years down the line. And, you know, that sounds very overly dramatic in some ways, but I think it is this kind of message that they're trying to get across. I think the fact that they're using special forces teams to strike these guys, it's not particularly new. You know, I mean, this is what these guys are trained for, you know, and they've got, you know, and now, frankly, the Obama administration has been very big on using, you know, drones and using methods that are not large armies going in to take over places to counter terrorism. I think this is an extension of that policy. I think it's an affirmation of it. I think it's also the strike against Shabab in particular is something that was really a recognition of a group that people had was continuing to sort of boil along, but people figured it was kind of maybe going to peter out. I think the fact that it was managed, they launched the Westgate attack, kind of surprised everyone a little bit. The size of it and the ambition involved and the effectiveness of it really showed that that was a group that people should be worried about. And so the U.S. striking in this way in the middle of one of the cities which was still sort of Shabab controlled is a demonstration that, you know, we have reached right into your territory. So I think it sort of sends a big message in that perspective.
Alessio, very quickly before we head to the news, just tell me, how effective do you think in the long run these sorts of raids are going to be?
I think this is going to remain one of the most effective weapons in at their disposal. You see, already at the beginning of the 2000s, one of the key delivery assets for this for these groups, the Virginia class of nuclear submarines, they were modified to host these groups, to have this type of teams operating from there. And so what has been built over the past 10 years is an incredible sets of capabilities to operate in areas that were not within the grasp of these groups. These groups were always targeting, you know, highly valued military targets at the conventional level. Now we know that they can be used to go after terrorists as well as conduct the sort of standard state-on-state type of focused action. So from this point of view, I think what we're looking at is a clear statement of the fact that whether large operations or not are in question in years to come, what certainly is going to stay is that resilient element of capability to hit at the very heart of whatever major threat is coming around.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. Well, we're going to have to leave it there because it's just hit 30 minutes past the hour here on Aperitivo. Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, and Alessio Patilano from King's College London. Thank you both very much indeed for joining me here at Midori House.
Thank you.
Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monocle 24 です.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
31 minutes past the hour. We have plenty still to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe soon for coffee and conversation with writer Adam Thirlwell, and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily. Before we get started on that, though, here's James Luckhurst with the world news headlines.
At least 22 people have been killed in a series of explosions across the Iraqi capital Baghdad. There are reports of at least six apparently coordinated bomb attacks in mainly commercial areas of the city. The majority were reported in mainly Shia districts, but a predominantly Sunni Muslim neighbourhood was also hit, according to Reuters news agency. Attacks in different regions of Egypt have left at least 9 soldiers and police officers dead. Officials said a car bomb killed 3 police officers in southern Sinai, hours after masked gunmen shot dead 6 soldiers in a patrol car outside the Suez Canal city of Ismailia. President Hamid Karzai has criticised NATO for failing to bring stability to Afghanistan in more than a decade there. He said NATO had incorrectly focused the fight on Afghan villages rather than Taliban safe havens in Pakistan. Prosecutors in France have dropped a criminal investigation into former French President Nicolas Sarkozy for allegedly soliciting secret campaign financing from France's richest woman. And the Americans, James Rothman and Randy Scheckman, and Germany's Thomas Sutthof have won the 2013 Nobel Medicine Prize for their work on how hormones are transported within and outside cells. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. And hats off to those guys winning the Nobel Prize for Medicine. I'm in awe. Welcome back to Aperitivo. We are live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, and 14:33 if you're lucky enough to be in Rio de Janeiro. Well, it's time now to head over to the Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street, just down the road, for coffee and a chat. Today, we're with writer and novelist Adam Thirlwell. Adam is the author of two novels, most recently 2009's The Escape, and I hear that he's putting the finishing touches to a new one that's out next year, titled Lurid and Cute. He's joined now by Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards. Tom, over to you.
Thank you very much indeed, Clemency. Yes, here I am at the Monocle Cafe alongside Adam Thirlwell. And as you rightly point out, Clemency, he is putting the finishing touches, I understand, to his much-anticipated new novel, which will be out next year. Lurid and Cute, the name of it, Adam. I wanted to ask you a bit about that process of actually sort of finishing up. How do you sort of know instinctively when your works are definitely finished? What's that end game like?
It's definitely an end game. I'm not sure you ever know it's definitely finished. You just send it to your editor in despair and think it's got to end sometime. So at the moment, it's just because I'm working to a deadline of the end of the year, and so it has to be done by the end of the year. So whatever state it's in at the end of the year, that will mean it's finished.
And it intrigues me, once you've had a few notable successes, does that buy you a bit more latitude, end of the year? Can you sort of say to them, hey, I'm Adam Thirlwell, it's going to be end of January at best, or do you find that you're still very well behaved, really?
To be honest, I have actually missed one deadline already, so that's why I'm taking this one so seriously, is that I think I've used up my tiny credit that I had, so yeah, this is a real deadline.
And what about the rest of the kind of your writerly responsibilities? Because I know you've just been on the road. We've given you a hopefully revitalising macchiato here at the Monocle Cafe to try and help you stay awake. It's quite a frenetic schedule, isn't it? How do you find that you bear up to that? Is it a process you enjoy, or sometimes do you just sort of hanker for being at home and, you know, getting to bed at the normal time and being able to live a normal life?
Yeah, I've just got back from South America from 2 weeks doing readings and lectures as part of a festival in both Buenos Aires and Santiago. And to be honest, I said yes to that festival when I thought I would have already finished this novel. So normally I wouldn't necessarily have just disappeared for 2 weeks. So I was finding it quite hard. I was literally writing in Sao Paulo airport. I was there with my laptop feeling quite exhausted. But on the other hand, something really fun about it. I mean, like, it would be ridiculous to get kind of depressed by having to go and do readings in Buenos Aires. That's a great pleasure in life, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. And I wonder, what's it like, obviously, then when you sort of engage with your readership in a lot of different ways? Presumably you have correspondence from readers and you meet them at these kind of events. How would you characterise your relationship? A lot of writers have a very almost sort of intimate personal relationship with their readers. Others, it's a bit more of a sort of a fractured relationship. How would you characterise it? Or do you think it depends? There's so much variation for you.
It very much varies, I think, and it also obviously depends in which country. And if you're in I can't speak Spanish, so I'd say my contact with my friends areas was not as intimate as it should have been. But I think it's interesting, because for me, I find what I like in writing is deliberately trying to blur the kind of distance between the reader and the writer. Like, I quite like making that as small as possible, and so I do quite enjoy meeting readers, and I quite enjoy doing these kind of readings or appearances, because there's a way in which it's quite interesting trying to play around with, you know, the persona you have as a writer, the narrative voice you use, and then the voice you might use to give a reading or to, you know, give an interview. Kind of the ways you can kind of alter slightly the way you're talking, and I find that quite fun.
And it's intriguing hearing you talk that way, because you mentioned some of the sort of themes that run through some of your writings, particularly your books about sort of, well, not about criticism, I suppose they almost are works of literary criticism as well in some respects. Where did that come from, that interest? Is it a mix of a sort of an academic approach and a creative approach, or was it something as you read when you were younger that you always thought, I'm interested in that, the meeting of the writerly and the critical, or is it just something that you sort of happened upon as your writing career developed?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's, I mean, yeah, I've written one book of criticism, and I still write kind of essays here and there, and I suppose it's just partly the way I write is the way I think, and so that there's always, I'm always, whenever I'm writing, there is always this self-critical bit of me kind of analysing and trying to work out what I'm doing. So it kind of seems natural to continue that thinking in a, you know, so it's true that certainly the kind of novel I like writing, there might be essayistic kind of elements in it, that it doesn't have to be just pure fiction. And I suppose this kind of tradition, you know, yeah, I studied literature at university, and certainly the writers who really influenced me then, like often quite Central European writers like Kundera, Robert Musil, these kind of people who's either did write criticism themselves or even within whose novels there are suddenly these weird little essays or kind of authorial moments. So, yeah, I don't see much... I certainly don't see a contradiction between it. On the other hand, I think I'm slightly... not bored of it, but certainly at the moment I'm quite enjoying being in pure fiction.
It's a nice place to be. Let me just ask you about some of your plans for a writing school. Now, I think, again, it's happening next year, presumably in your post-completion sort of glow. And it's a wonder event. Tell me a bit about it, because am I right in thinking sort of writers and critics, to talk about blurring these lines again, we'll kind of take on each other's role? Is this more of a continuation of this? What's your thinking behind this one?
I think always when I'm writing, I always like to have some extra weird project on the go. And so I'd been vaguely toying with this. I've been talking about a bit with people at Oxford University of that would be the most playful writing school ever. So it'd be like a pop-up writing school for one day only. And the thing that I was really interested in was exactly this problem of there's a kind of way in which people sometimes think, well, the way a critic thinks is the way it's different to the way a novelist thinks. And it's always intrigued me that the way people talk about literature when they only study it is very different from when you get a group of novelists together, they talk about writing in a completely different way. And often in a completely different way even to how they might write criticism. So it was like, what I liked the idea of was therefore a writing school where critics would have to write fiction and fiction writers would have to write criticism. It would in some way that everyone would be doing the wrong thing. And it would be a way of really thinking, I think I'm interested in, is there such a thing as novelistic thinking? You know, like, is it a specific kind of way of thinking that is completely different to other ways? So that's the kind of joke. Well, no, it's a serious examination, but then the writing school itself is a kind of slightly practical joke to try and analyse it.
Lovely stuff, and it's not anything to do. You haven't got any particular critics marked out for vengeance. That's not what this is all about, is it?
Not at all. It's purely a purely joyful occasion.
Wonderful stuff. Adam Thorwell, thanks very much for coming to speak to us. Remind us, Lyrid and Cute, due out
in September, God willing.
Wonderful stuff. Well, we'll look forward to reading it, and I might even sign up for that writing school myself. That's Adam Thirlwell. Clemency, back over to you in the studio at Midori House.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom. I will see you there on that writing course. I definitely plan to sign up for that. Sounds joyous indeed. That was Tom Edwards in conversation with writer Adam Thirlwell down the road at the Monocle Cafe. Up next, we're on a yacht in Italy. Well, some of the luckiest among us are anyway. Stay tuned to find out more here on Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Clemency Burton-Hill. The time is 18.42 here in London. Oh, just hit 18.43. Now, while most of us have said goodbye to summer and swapped our swimsuits for slightly warmer attire, boat builders in Europe are already gearing up for next year's big holiday season on the Mediterranean. This past month has seen shipyards, both large and small, showing off the latest luxury super yachts and weekend sailboats in Cannes and Monaco to tempt the seafaring public. Well, I don't know about public, but at least those who can take to the seas in such vessels. This past week, it was Italy's turn as the nation's yacht makers unveiled new models at the annual Genoa Boat Show. The event was a downsized version compared to previous editions, given the rough economic seas that Italy currently finds itself in. But the sector is hoping for a bit of relief by luring buyers from abroad. Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho paid a visit pierside at Genoa to learn more.
In 2008, Italy's yacht building industry, the world's biggest, was riding a wave of prosperity with over 6 billion euros in orders. But 5 years after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the sector still faces headwinds. 20,000 jobs have been shed and sales are down 60%, as people prefer to charter yachts or buy second-hand. Yet some believe the worst is now behind them. Stefano Campanelli, sales director at the Ferretti Group.
We see some light at the end of the tunnel. And we have restarted selling boats, even boats of a certain importance in terms of feet, of footage, of length. And so all this is really encouraging for the company, for our group.
Now, where do you see growth today with Europe still in a delicate situation? Are those emerging markets getting more and more important?
We are opening the greater China market through a number of showrooms, new offices, because we are confident that the Chinese market represents an opportunity, a big challenge for our group.
One of the country's biggest producers, with brands that include classic runabouts made by Riva, Ferretti has righted itself after being bought by a Chinese industrial group last year. The company is going after newly minted millionaires from Istanbul to Hong Kong, eager to get their hands on tailor-made Italian luxury yachts.
We are in a position to adapt the product within a certain limit to the local demands. It's easy to understand that the expectations of a Chinese customer are not the same of an Italian customer, are not the same of an American customer. So just to give you an example, when we sell a boat in China, according to our first experiences, most of our boat owners demand to dismantle a cabin and to turn it into a karaoke room, because for them the boat is a business tool at the time being, which is not the case in Italy, for instance. So this is an example of a very peculiar request that we are able to satisfy.
So they like to have business meetings with a karaoke bar.
They like to have business meetings. The boat is, in their mentality, according to their mindset, a status symbol.
The majority of the 750 exhibitors were pushing powerboats on prospective owners. But there were still plenty of classic sailboats, many now easier to navigate, less costly, and outfitted with fancier quarters, including oak cabinets and kitchen countertops in Corian. Ruggero Gandolfi is managing director at Gran Soleil.
We are here now on our last model, our 43. Nowadays, sailing is day by day more a pleasure and can be afforded by new entry guys that are not boating, but they would start the experience, feeling the elements, feeling the sea, feeling the wind. Of course, with a lower price than in respect of power boats. Sailing is not impossible as maybe it was years and years ago, because now the boats are very easy handling. Everything can be done by some good electric winch. Of course, today there is a lot of people are talking about being green, and about on the seaside, being green means 100% to sail. But we should even think that running costs on a sailboat are much lower because you need less maintenance. Of course, you need less fuel, and so you can really cruise for a long while without caring about the fact that it's costing a fortune.
Foreign builders were also in attendance, keen to compete on Italian soil for orders in the all-important Mediterranean market. Based on a lake in the Austrian Alps, family-run Frauscher makes powerboats for day cruising. Florian Helmberger is the company's sales manager.
It's a completely different design philosophy. So with Frauscher, we try to pull back everything you don't need in a boat. So our boats are basically high performance on a very, very clean level, like a modern architecture, for example, with the straight bow design, clean surfaces, no frills, but still all the details are made in the highest possible quality.
Now, how important is it to be in Genoa?
For us, it's very important because basically the Italians are the benchmark. Everybody is setting their boats up against, and so we want to be part of this family. We want to be recognized as one of the leading powerboat manufacturers.
Do you see the European market coming back?
Yeah, we already see coming back slowly, though. We see a lot of growth from Middle East. So we have lots of new customers from Saudi Arabia, from Dubai, and we are picking up some sales from Australia even. But the main market is still in Europe.
After 5 days of courting customers, talk at Genoa hinted at an industry poised for a rebound. Orders trickled in to give hope that boatyards won't be idle this winter in the run-up to next year's summer cruising season. For Monocle, in Genoa, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
Well, after all that, I think it's time for a bit of music, and I think we should stick with the nautical theme, don't you? Something from all the way back in 1982. This is 6 Months on a Leaky Boat by New Zealand art rock group Split Enz. That was 6 Months on a Leaky Boat by New Zealand's Split Enz. You're listening to Aperitivo. It's 18:53 in London. That means we're fast approaching the end of the programme, very sadly. But before we go, let's have a quick look ahead to what's coming up on Monocle 24 later in the day. I'm joined in the studio now by producers Marcus Hippie and Barbara Feeney. Very warm welcome to you both.
Hello, Clemency.
Now, tell me what is on the menu this evening. Not in the menu, but in Globalist Asia, for example.
Globalist Asia menu. We start the programme with a look at what's been going on at the annual APEC summit that's taking place on the Indonesian island of Bali. One key figure is missing there, although world leaders and business leaders are gathering there. But obviously, US President Barack Obama is not there for obvious reasons. We are going to be talking about whether that matters, how much, and what the big themes are going to be on this summit over there. We start with that, but then after that we talk about weather as well. It was a couple of months ago when China was experiencing massive problems with pollution, and it seems that this heavy smog is doing a comeback at the moment. So, heavy
all over China or in particular cities?
Heavy smog. Well, actually, the smog has been attacking Beijing and other parts of northern China on Sunday and Monday. It's been causing massive problems for all those poor millions of travellers who were trying to return from their week-long national holidays.
Of course, yeah.
Massive problems. Flights have been cancelled as well. And on the Globalist Asia, we also talk aviation. Aircraft manufacturing giant Airbus has announced that it has got a massive deal with Japanese carrier Japan Airlines. It's going to deliver 31 planes, all are going to be of A350 model, and that is quite a blow for Boeing, which has dominated Japan's aviation market for so long.
Interesting stuff. Now, Marcus, you're producing the show, aren't you? You're
not. I am producing.
Who have we got in the hot seat then? Who's presenting?
Emma Nelson is going to be on the hot seat, presenting the show.
The lovely Emma Nelson. Barbara, over to you. Tell us what's in store.
Hello, Clemency. So on the daily, we have Andrew Muller and Gillian Dubias.
And to start off the show, we are going to be in the US nearly a week after the US government shutdown. And we're going to take a particular look at John Boehner and his role in the whole government shutdown. And we're going to be looking at the Republican Party as well and how radicalised they've become.
Tell you what, two jobs you wouldn't really envy at the moment, John Boehner's and Barack Obama's. I mean,
so true.
Not to mention anyone else actually involved in it, but yeah, fascinating
stuff. Tough job.
Spotlight on Boehner for this evening.
Yes, and then we are moving back to Europe. We're going to Portugal, where the post office is becoming privatised. So this is part of a measure to help them deal with their immense debt. So we're going to look at that because they're following in the footsteps of a few other countries in Europe.
Well, indeed, today the Royal Mail shares. It's the end of that scramble for shares in the Royal Mail.
Yeah,
Mail
so
here in Europe.
We're going to see what that means, kind of take a wider look at what it means in Europe and for Portugal itself. And then we are back over to the US. We're kind of going back and forth. Tomorrow they are introducing a new $100 bill. So it's 100 years since this bill was introduced, or the original one was introduced. So we're going to look at it. There's going to be some new features on this bill to prevent, the bill being kind of replicated. And, you know, it'll be interesting look just the day before it's launched.
Do we know? Do we have any sneak previews of what it's going
yes,
to look like?
Yes, there is a few sneak previews of what's going to feature on it. And there's some interesting kind of watermarks. And it looks far more sophisticated than the existing bill.
I can't say I've had much familiarity with $100 bills, more's the pity. What about you, Marcus?
I haven't. It seems like every single time when I'm in the US, I've got the same European problem, which is trying to differentiate the notes. You have quite a few notes in your pocket, then you're trying to figure out which is which. And in the end, you just throw them all on the table and just go them all through.
You have that nice
one by
fat
one.
Wallet feeling and you think, oh, it's all good, I can afford that cup of coffee.
And then you have about $7 over there.
All ones. Well, thank you very much to you both. I hope you have wonderful shows. Looking forward to those. Globalist Asia, followed by The Daily here on Monocle 24. Well, we are, as I say, fast approaching the end of the show at 18:57 here in London. That's all we have time for on Aperitivo. My warmest thanks in particular to our special guests earlier on the show, Raffaello Pantucci and Alessio Patilano. They talked us through the latest developments at the APEC summit in Indonesia. And as Michael's just mentioned, you can hear more on that on tonight's Globalist Asia. Today's Aperitivo, though, was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Alexa Firmenich. And our studio manager was the ever heroic Bill Luti. Next up tonight is Culture with Rob Bound. This week there's a bit of a film theme, as we'll be speaking to John Baer, the director of new release Filth. We'll take a peek at Adam Curtis and Massive Attack's new collaborative audio-visual project, and we'll chat to one of the UK's very top film critics, Mark Kermode.
I wanted to love it. I wanted it to be great. 5 minutes in, it was like, oh no, this is hell. He has done that classic thing of he has opened a window on his soul and it is a gaping abyss of black horror.
Unlike the Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily, which will be here from 2000 hours London time. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Aperitivo, from me, Clemency Burton-Hill, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.